This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we bring you a special examination of the sexual violence epidemic and cover-ups within the Catholic Church. Survivor Peter Isley and attorney Pam Spees join us for the entire hour. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. How does the Catholic Church evaluate cases of pedophilia committed by priests? This is the first question in the pamphlet titled Pedophilia and the Priesthood by Monsignor Raffaello Martinelli. The answer reads in part, these crimes of pedophilia have been labeled as a crime against the most weak, a horrendous sin in the eyes of God, a crime that damages the Church's credibility. The most severe condemnation, a source of clear and unequivocal blame, is found in the words of Jesus when, identifying himself with the little ones, affirms in the Synoptic Gospels, "And whoever receives one child, such as this in my name, receives me. Whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, it would be better for him to have a great millstone hung around his neck and to be drowned in the depths of the sea." In August 2018, it came to light that for over 70 years, Roman Catholic bishops and other church officials in Pennsylvania covered up child sexual abuse by more than 300 priests. An attorney general report says that they dissuaded victims from reporting the abuse, and they convinced police not to investigate it. The report, initiated by Attorney General Josh Shapiro, is the widest inquiry by a U.S. government agency into Catholic Church sexual abuse and violence directed at children. It found more than 1,000 identifiable victims, but says there are likely thousands more whose records have been lost or who were too afraid to come forward. It says the cover-up by senior church officials reached at times up to the Vatican. Today on Law and Disorder, we bring you a special examination of the continuing revelations into the extent of sexual abuse of children by Catholic priests and the cover-ups of this abuse by church officials. Our guests are Pam Spees and Peter Isley. Pam is an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York. She has worked closely with SNAP, the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, since 2011. With the filing of a complaint at the International Criminal Court. The complaint called for an investigation and prosecution of high-level Vatican officials, including then-Pope Benedict, for the widespread and systematic rape and sexual violence within the Catholic Church. Peter Isley is a founding member of End Clergy Abuse, a new global organization launched in Geneva in June. It consists of survivor leaders and human rights activists from 5 continents and 28 countries. Peter wrote a 2003 SNAP white paper to the Department of Justice calling for federal intervention into the matter of clergy sexual abuse. Peter begins our discussion by clarifying terminology such as abuse and sexual violence.
All these acts, and we're specifically talking about criminal acts in particular. This is about violence. And abuse is a term, when you think about it, if you've abused something, you can then correctly use it. The problem is how you're doing it. And that's not what this is about. This is about, some of the most profound forms of life-changing violence in the body and in the mind. And in the soul of a child and a person that can possibly occur. So getting the language correct and naming it and stating it for what it is absolutely essential, or we can't intervene in it and we can't stop it.
Peter addresses why it has been so difficult to get government leaders to conduct investigations in the United States. He also talks about the relationship between church and state in this matter.
With our original request to the Justice Department, is something that is pretty obvious when you think about it. And sort of what's happening now, 15 years later, is kind of obvious, too. But that request, which was carefully crafted and put together, was simply a request for an investigation in the United States, a federal-level investigation of the bishops and the structure of the Catholic Church and how they were using that structure nationally in order to cover up for child sex crimes. And to move child sex offenders, not only within a particular state, which of course had been by that point extremely well documented and proven, but they were moving sex offenders across state lines and international lines. And specifically in our request, what we had documented and proven and demonstrated is the church had set up a number of retreat house or treatment facilities in which were collection points, in which they were sending sex offenders who had been determined to have abused children, and they were sending them to these treatment centers without notifying law enforcement, without any investigation by law enforcement, without notifying parishes and the public. And they were sending them to these centers with extremely questionable forms of treatment that they were providing for them, in order to keep them for, say, a few months, send all the information that they were getting about this offender's criminal history, because that's where you were going to get the most documented and detailed history of what they were doing, and then put them back in ministry in their diocese in some other location where they would offend again. So what these treatment centers were proving is that this was a national effort that they were doing, and that they were linked together because of this as a national organization and body. And there's been screaming headlines about this in every city, even every small town in the United States. And where is the Justice Department? There has not been one congressional hearing about this in all these years, which is astonishing. You have congressional hearings about virtually everything. And subsequently, since that time, there has been governmental investigations around the world, particularly in Ireland, also in Germany, but most dramatically in the last 5 years in Australia. And what that government did is that their Justice Department, the equivalent of that, did a full forensic investigation of exactly what has been going on in Australia with this. And that's what has to absolutely happen in the United States. Our request to the Justice Department was pretty simple. You have absolutely incontrovertible proof that this is going on, that there's a national network run by the American bishops, and then ultimately the Vatican, which is doing this, and it has to be investigated, that the evidence for prosecution of many of these offenders and for the senior managers of the church doing this was there. There was certainly enough evidence for an investigation, and, you know, it's time to launch that investigation. You know, this is going to come as a surprise, but it's a lot about politics. So, I mean, everybody, I think, knew back then when we made this request, and it's still true now, where all this is going to lead. And it's going to lead to Rome, and it's going to lead to the Vatican. That's who is ultimately in charge of this operation. The Vatican is a sovereign state. We acknowledge them as a sovereign state, which is very, very problematic when it comes to this issue, because they've been using that sovereignty to move criminal evidence from one country over to the Vatican. I mean, when you think about this, and what's incredible when you think about it, is where has been our government? And where has been our ambassador to the Vatican? I mean, you have thousands and thousands of children and others that are being harmed in our country. We're citizens of this country by basically employees of the Catholic Church, priests. Only the Pope can hire and fire a priest, literally. And all of that information about their criminal behavior and the harm they're doing and the cover-up is leaving the United States, and it's all going to another country. They got to go over to that other country, a bishop here, and he's got to get permission from them, ultimately, in order to remove this man from working with children and families. And so you've got that. And nobody, you know, it's a political third rail, I think, because they know where it's going to go. You know, I'm speculating, but when you do something like this, you don't know what's going to come out. You don't know where it's going to lead. And I think that's been the hesitancy. But there's also, culturally in the United States, this line between church and state is a very fluid line. You know, there are powers and lobbyists and politics deeply involved with religion in the United States and about establishing where that line is going to be. And the Catholic bishops, who wield a considerable amount of influence and power in Washington and elsewhere, have used that influence and power in order to maintain this system of theirs, which incorporates what I'm talking about. And so there's a great hesitancy, a political hesitancy, to do that because of the potential political response, I think, for an elected official about how that's going to go with Catholic voters, frankly, in their district. It's just something they don't want to take on. And they clearly have not made a decision that they're going to do that. Now, we're seeing some changes in some states, some important dramatic changes, like you've seen in Pennsylvania recently with the grand jury investigation. And that was one grand jury investigation among several over the years. And there's nothing in that Pennsylvania grand jury report that is shocking or surprising or should be to anybody. What was in that grand jury report, the documents and evidence that they had, the witnesses that they talked to, that has been the case wherever there has been exposure of this. And sometimes it's come through, very importantly, through civil court action. Sometimes it's come through bankruptcies where the church has had to go into bankruptcy in Milwaukee and St. Paul recently. And what you see in those documents and in the evidence is exactly the same thing that you see in recently in Pennsylvania.
There has been no comprehensive measurement of the full scope of child sexual abuse and violence in the Catholic Church in the United States, although many have attempted to do so. The Pennsylvania grand jury said that church officials follow, quote, a playbook for concealing the truth. They would minimize stories of abuse by using words such as inappropriate contact to describe acts of rape.
As a survivor, you know, I read that report as a survivor of being raped and sexually assaulted by a priest as a youngster in Wisconsin. Every survivor who read that report read something in that report that was so similar to what happened to him or her. And for me, there was a story in that report from a victim, and it was this. There was a ring of pedophile priests, which is not unusual for pedophiles to operate in rings. They're moving a victim from one priest to the other. And in this particular story, incident, they had the youngster, the priest did, in his bedroom. And he put the youngster on his bed, to stand on his bed. And he was naked. The child was naked. He instructed the child to extend his arms in the exact same posture as Jesus on the cross. And he photographed that youngster in that posture so he could take those photographs and pass them on to the other priests in the ring. When I was a child, I was assaulted at a boarding school. It was a seminary. I was 13 in Wisconsin. It was in the middle of Wisconsin. It was on a hill. It was called St. Lawrence Seminary. It's actually still operating. And the priest who assaulted me, he would pull me out of the bed at the middle of the night. It was like dorm. It was a dorm. It was bunks. He would come into the dorm in the middle of the night, and he would wake me up, and he would take me to his office, which was outside the dorm, and if I refused to comply with his demands, what he would do is that he would then take me out to the hallway outside the dorm. There were steps, and it was very cold. In this particular incident I'm going to talk about, it was winter. I was in my pajamas, and he made me kneel on these stone steps facing a wall, a brick wall, and he would leave me out there. This is like 2:30 in the morning, and he would come by, and he would make his demands again. It was for oral sex. And if I refused or didn't comply, as I did in this particular incident, he took a broomstick, and he placed those broomsticks, the broomstick under my knees. So I'm kneeling with the broomstick under my knees, facing the wall in the cold, in my pajamas, and he left again. And this interminable amount of time out there in pain, he came back, and I refused again. And then he told me, instructed me, that I had to hold out my arms, just like that victim in the Pennsylvania story, hold out my arms. And he put, like, heavy books that I had to hold in each of my hands. And so I'm kneeling there with the broomstick under my knees, facing the wall, holding these books, my arms outstretched, like Christ on the cross. And he came out again. If my arms were flagging, he would make me stay longer, hold them up and stay longer, until I eventually complied. And every Catholic or every person who goes into every church in the world, what they see when they walk into that church is a crucifix. A lot of people have crucifixes in their home. And if you read that report, that's what you see. If you're a Catholic and you've read that report, or anybody, when you see from now on a crucifix and you see that tortured man on that crucifix, you are seeing that child who was standing on that bed.
When asked if these crimes can be prosecuted as acts of torture, Pam Spies discusses some of the legal initiatives undertaken.
We hope there will be torture prosecutions. We made that argument to the International Criminal Court in 2011 when we went with Peter and other survivors from the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests to The Hague, along with about 20,000 pages of documentation of this crisis. We brought that complaint to the ICC because these are crimes against humanity, right? These are some of the most serious crimes of concern to the international community as a whole. And we felt that it is something the world's first permanent criminal court should be investigating. When you're talking about the scale and scope, and then certainly the magnitude of the harm. And we asked them to investigate the high-level officials, from the Pope down to four other high-level ranking officials who operate just below the Pope, for overseeing this system of torture and sexual violence. And we said specifically, torture is a crime against humanity. It's within the court's jurisdiction, and this is torture, and it should be prosecuted, in addition to prosecuting it as rape and forms of sexual violence. So since then, we have gone to the United Nations Committees on the Rights of the Child and the Committee Against Torture. And this was the first time that the Vatican had been called to report to those committees. As you heard Peter said, that the Vatican sees itself as a state. I think it's second only to the United States in the number of embassies it has around the world and diplomatic relations with countries around the world. We don't necessarily agree as a legal matter that it is a state, but it is certainly, it holds itself out that way and it is treated that way. It's a state when it's convenient for it to be a state, and it's a religion when it's better from the church's point of view to operate as a religion. And so it gets the benefit of both and manages to escape accountability in both realms often. And so the Vatican, ironically, had ratified the Convention on the Rights of the Child. And that convention requires reporting. It requires sort of submitting to the recommendations of this committee that oversees compliance. And so when the Vatican ratified it, it sort of held itself out as setting a moral example for the world that everyone should ratify this, every country should ratify this treaty. But it saw it as symbolic, and others in, you know, the United Nations and other countries also saw it as symbolic, and I don't think anyone ever intended to hold the Vatican accountable to it, right? And then so fast forward, and so it was never reporting. Other countries have to go regularly and report on what steps they're taking to comply with these treaties, and the Vatican had never done so until 2014. And by that point, the evidence of the scale and scope of this crisis around the world had really, it had become so obvious that it couldn't be ignored. And so SNAP, with CCR, we presented these reports to the committee, and the committee called the Vatican to report. And it was the first time that Vatican officials have had to sit there before these committees and answer these questions all day long. And they very quickly ran out of talking points, right? And so what was very positive and what was a major step forward is that the Committee on Torture in particular took this very seriously, and the Vatican did everything it could do to try to, in advance, even impliedly threatening to withdraw from the treaty if the committee chose to deal with the issue of sexual violence within the church by clergy at its hearing. The committee didn't bow down. It didn't deter the committee. They had a full vetting of these issues. Both committees have issued a series of recommendations and questions. They've asked for follow-up reporting, and the Vatican has not responded. I will just say that on this issue of the church-state piece, what was so horrific is that the church in the U.S., and Peter has seen this up close in Wisconsin, they will actually attempt to shield any inquiry by civil authorities into the church, into different dioceses' handling of the issue of the cases of sexual violence, throwing up a First Amendment shield that this is an interference with religion. And they've been successful in different cases around the country. So we see that happening. And that's what I mean, right? Where they take advantage of you know, operating as a religion on the one hand, operating as a state on the other, and then trying to avoid the accountability mechanisms in, you know, that are available in both. The other point I wanted to make about what the Vatican was suggesting, which is so disingenuous before these committees, is that it claimed that it was only responsible for what happens within the confines of Vatican City, right? That because it is a state and that is its territory, its responsibility for adherence to the Convention on the Rights of the Child or the Convention Against Torture begins and ends within the confines of Vatican City. They literally said that, and they said whatever else happens anywhere in the world, that's the responsibility of those governments, which is appalling and ludicrous when you consider how much church officials have done to subvert the course of justice in these countries where evidence of the crimes has emerged. So, and they do that through the cover-ups that we know about that have been documented most recently in Pennsylvania, but those cover-ups have been being documented for a long time in the U.S. and elsewhere, and they do it through trying to defeat statute of limitations reforms for civil windows of time to bring older cases. Millions of dollars of church funds are going into those fights. And then we know it, you know, some of the treatment centers Peter mentioned earlier have to do with attempts by church officials to avoid mandatory reporting. You know, so those weren't placed in places where there was mandatory reporting requirements for social workers or counselors or, you know, in particular, there's documented evidence that Cardinal Mahoney in the Los Angeles Archdiocese was shipping people out for treatment to places specifically where there were no mandatory reporting requirements. So all of these ways in which the church authorities, and as Peter said, this goes all the way back to Rome, attempt to thwart any accountability at national levels. It was so disingenuous for church officials to sit there before those committees and suggest that their responsibility begins and ends in the Vatican, and everything else is everyone else's fault. At the same time, right, it is absolutely true that it is also the responsibility of governments and around the world to investigate and prosecute these crimes. So that's why we also went to the Committee Against Torture when the United States was reporting, and we called this failing at the national level, at the federal level, to the committee's attention, right? Because survivors have been calling for an investigation since 2003. And there wasn't one. We did it again in 2014 at the Committee Against Torture, bringing these issues both to the attention of the U.S. government and the committee, and still nothing, right? And so it is true that it is everyone's responsibility, but it's primarily the place where this can be stopped is at the Vatican. And as Peter has often said, with the stroke of a pen, the Pope could make a vital change that would go a long way toward protecting children in the future.
Peter sees some of the recent events in Vatican City as actually moving in a positive direction.
There's a lot kind of happening right now, and with this issue on with the Pope and on the Vatican level, which is actually, I think, good, in the sense that I think people are beginning to see what kind of management team is claiming that they can be in charge of sex offenders around the world, which they are, and that they can protect children. So the recent development over the past few days is about this. The former papal nuncio or ambassador from the Vatican to the United States made public I think it's 12-page letter, a narrative, in which he claims, and this has not been proven, this is his claim, that Pope Francis covered up knowledge of sexual abuse by former Washington, D.C. Archbishop and Cardinal McCarrick, and that he knew about this, and that he didn't take action, and that, in fact, the previous Pope, Benedict, had allegedly taken some kind of action against McCarrick. So basically what he's saying in this letter is that Pope Francis covered up for McCarrick and the sexual abuse that he had committed. None of this has been proven or demonstrated. The documents in the McCarrick file in the embassy and in the D.C., Washington, D.C., I would think, in the Archdiocese of Washington and elsewhere where McCarrick was, have not been released. And so that's kind of what's happening now. The Pope, on his way out of Ireland, said that he's not going to respond to this. And he challenged journalists on the plane to, I guess, do their job and determine what is the truth. What's really strange about that is journalists can't do their job about what the truth is about this allegation if they can't see the evidence and the documents. And certainly Pope Francis could do that. He could order those documents to be released because they're his documents. So there's a lot of confusion going on right now, which is not good for survivors. The Pope wants us to have confidence in him. He wants the world to have confidence in him that he's going to end these cover-ups by bishops of child sex crimes and that he's going to stop the harm that pedophile priests are committing around the world. And he hasn't really done that. He went to Ireland. I was there. And he expressed, again, a lot of personal sorrow about these crimes and these cover-ups, and he apologized again. And Pope Benedict started with apologies. I don't know how many there's been. There's been quite a lot of them, and there's kind of apology fatigue right now And it's time to move beyond apologies and feeling bad about it and to tell us exactly what you're going to do about it. And the Pope had a opportunity in Ireland to tell us and tell the world how he's going to stop this. Instead, he didn't say how he was going to stop it. And on the way out, he said something which is really important that has been lost in the coverage. It's in there, but it's been lost, and it's really important. 3 years ago, he announced with a lot of fanfare that he's going to set up a tribunal in the Vatican for the first time to investigate and judge bishops who have covered up child sex crimes. And he's going to hold them accountable. He got a lot of credit for saying that. Marie Collins, who is a survivor from Ireland, was on a papal commission that the Pope had set up. And he told Collins on the way out of Ireland that he's not going to set up that tribunal. It's not going to happen. And it would have been good if he would have told us that 3 years ago. And he's saying that everything we've got now is fine, that we've solved the problem. And that is an incredibly important and alarming position and statement that he made leaving Ireland. The Pope and the Vatican have to do three things. They should have done it a long time ago. It's completely confusing and perplexing to survivors as to why they haven't done it. And here are the three things that they must do, and he could do it with the stroke of a pen tomorrow morning. One, zero tolerance for sexual violence by clerics and religious order individuals around the world that have been determined to have sexually abused or raped a child or a vulnerable adult. Under church law, there's been a slight change just in the United States, but under church law around the globe, under their law, you can be a priest, you can sexually assault and abuse a youngster, a child, you can work with children and families doing that, you can be determined by your bishop to have done it, and you can remain working with children and families. You can do that under their law. That's the problem. I don't know any other occupation in civil society or around the world where we have civil society in which you can do that. So he talks about zero tolerance, but he has not written it into the law of the church, and that's all that matters. Secondly, zero tolerance for any bishop in which it has been proven, like it has been in Pennsylvania, that they have covered up for child sex crimes. This is a simple axiom of justice. It's not okay, for whatever reason, to cover up for child sex crimes. Now, in Pennsylvania, it has been proven that Cardinal Wuerl, in one particular horrendous case, not only covered up for this pedophile, he transferred that pedophile, knowing this, to another parish outside the state of Pennsylvania. So he facilitated the movement of this pedophile from one parish in Pennsylvania to a parish in another state. Now, you tell me why the U.S. Justice Department wouldn't be interested in that. And Cardinal Wuerl got on national television a day or two before that report came out. And he knew everything that was in that report, basically, because it's all about him in Pittsburgh, part of that report. And they had all the files from Pittsburgh. And why wouldn't the Vatican have had all those files? Of course they had all those files. And he went on national television, and he was asked. This is the Cardinal Archbishop of Washington, D.C. And he was asked, did you ever transfer one of these abusive priests? And he answered, he said, quote, that was not my process. I'm not sure the word process is the word to use, but he said, that was not my process. I didn't do that. And then the report comes out, and there he is with his signature and personal writing to this pedophile, writing to him I'm going to transfer you to this parish that you want to go to in Reno, Nevada. Now, I don't know what you call that, but it looks to me pretty clearly that that's a lie. If he was on the witness stand and asked that question, I don't know what you would call that but perjury. Now, Cardinal Wuerl right now is still the Cardinal Archbishop of Washington. The Pope has said nothing about this. And that's the problem. You can be a cardinal or a bishop and proven to have done this. You have a grand jury report that comes back and said, yeah, this is what he did. He covered up these sex crimes, and there is no accountability whatsoever. So there has to be zero tolerance for any bishop, under their law, for any bishop that has been proven to cover up for child sex crimes. And you can't do zero tolerance for abusive priests if you don't have zero tolerance for bishops that cover it up. So, yeah, you got to have those two things. And the third thing is that the Vatican and the Pope have direct information and knowledge in which they have determined. I cannot say this strongest terms possible. They have determined that this cleric is a child sex molester. They've determined it. They need to tell us who these individuals are. They need to have a registry, just like any professional occupation does, of the individuals that have committed these crimes. They need to do the equivalent of taking their license so they'll never be able to practice as a priest again. And they need to let law enforcement and parishes know who these individuals are. And the Vatican has, right now, at least 3,200 cases, some of the most serious cases from around the world, of pedophile priests. They've got this at the Vatican. They've determined that they've committed these crimes. And they're not letting any of us know who they are. And they're a sovereign state. They can do what they want with this. They need to start a global registry right now of these individuals and let us know who they are in the appropriate manner. And they need to publish that registry. And they need to do it from the Vatican, and they should have done it, and they need to do it tomorrow. That's the information that Catholic families need. I mean, think about this. I came from an incredibly devout Catholic family of eight. My father died when I was an infant. I was 9 months old with my twin brother. There were eight of us. A very, very Catholic family. My mother went to church every day. I went to Mass every day. These are Catholics that are being raped and assaulted, Catholic children. And, you know, this is our Catholic Church, and they used our Catholic faith. That's what these priests use, and the Pope and everybody full well knows this. This is the window and the door that these sex offenders use to get to children, and that's the door that has to be permanently shut. And if they don't do the three things I'm talking about, what they're doing is they're going to continue to invite, and it should happen anyways, government and law enforcement to get these files and to investigate this information so that citizens in our country and around the world, children around the world, that their rights, their basic human rights, their basic rights as children are protected.
Peter just returned from a trip to Ireland and describes the new global justice project and clergy abuse.
Ireland's an amazing place. I've been there, this is my third time there, and I've only been there for this issue. And yes, I have an Irish grandmother. For everything that was happening in Ireland with the Pope, the greatest thing about being in Ireland, for me personally, was to be with my brother and sister, Irish survivors. And I belong now to a global organization of survivors and activists. It's the first of its kind in the world. We launched in Geneva in June, End Clergy Abuse. It's a global justice project. These are among the most seasoned and experienced survivor leaders from around the globe. And we met with the Office of the High Commissioner of Human Rights when we were there. We met with the Committee of the Child. And so we were in Ireland with survivors from around the globe. And we wanted the survivors in Ireland to know that we were with them. When one survivor speaks, all survivors speak. And the disrespect, especially how this trip started, the Vatican and the Pope were not going to talk about this issue at all when he was in Ireland. That was their plan. And Archbishop Martin of Dublin, who I have met, who has voluntarily instituted zero tolerance in his diocese, he's written it into the law of his diocese. He went on television or with the press, and this is amazing, he had to do it this way, and he had to say, the Pope has to talk about this issue. He was coming to Ireland because of something that the church does every 3 years, which is called the World Meeting of Families. It's this big thing that they do about families. And that's why he was coming to Ireland, to end this World Meeting of Families, which is really interesting and somewhat ironic that they're going to do this thing about families when they've destroyed so many families, especially in Ireland. You cannot imagine, and there have been two government reports in Ireland which have been incredible and historic, the extent of the damage and harm that was done to families in Ireland. It's incredible. The institutions that they had, the boarding schools that they had. There are mass graves in Ireland that are being uncovered now and have been recently about children in these institutions that were abused and harmed and malnourished. It's unbelievable. So he's coming to this place in which there has been incredible suffering and sorrow. And for me to be able to join with Irish survivors and global survivors together and to really praise and thank these survivors in Ireland for the activism and what they have done over the years. They have been an example of what it means that when you're able to come forward as a survivor, when you're able to speak the truth, when you come out of that shame and silence, that is a transformative moment. The beginning of the Gospels, if people have read the Gospels, there's the beginning of the Gospel of John. And it's an incredible poetic sentence. And what it is that it says, in the beginning was the Word, and that the Word became flesh, became a body, became a person, meaning Jesus. And that's exactly what happens when a survivor comes forward. It's about coming out of this silence and speaking the Word. And that Word is what has a transformative effect, and we want it to have this transformative effect on changing the church. So they have spoken and come forward in Ireland. So they were being treated just with such disrespect by the Vatican that he was going to come in there and he wasn't going to talk about this. Well, that obviously changed a great deal. And what you can see in Ireland, what you experience in Ireland, is the power of survivors and how they're changing this issue and how they're changing the world for all children by doing this. And that was by far the most great experience that I had being with them. And because we're all the same. One survivor speaks, all survivors speak. We have survivors in Latin America, of course, now that has blown up there, in Chile and other places. And it's going to Africa. That's, I can tell you right now, that's the destination that it's going to, and that's an incredible challenge. It is very, very dangerous for children in some of these Catholic parishes and institutions in Africa. The bishops there in Africa, if you think you've got a problem with places, you know, like the United States and Cardinal Worrell, you can't imagine what it's like with some of these bishops in Africa, and that's where it's going. And I believe in my heart that it's the survivors of Africa and all of the challenges they're going to face in coming forward, and that we're going to be there for them, and we're going to give them what they need to come forward, that's really going to be the ultimate transformative moment and challenge with the church is when they come forward. And I know they're there. We're getting in contact with them. They're coming to us. And it's an enormous, enormous amount of suffering that has taken place there and is taking place there. And out of that sorrow and suffering that they're experiencing, I believe that's going to be the incredibly important moment with this, because survivors are, in a way, they're speaking from the place of universality, which is what the church tries to speak from. We form like our own country, and become a citizen of our country is a horrible way to become a citizen of our country, which is that you've been a victim of sexual violence by the church. And that's how you become a citizen of our country, but how you become somebody that changes the world, that you take that citizenship and you use it to make a change for every child in the world. They have plenty within their tradition of doctrine and the gospel to be able to address this properly. But it's what I spoke about before. They need to change their law, because under their doctrine right now, you can rape and sexually assault a child and remain a priest. So whatever you got to change in your doctrine to make that happen, that's what you better change. And they don't seem to be really concerned ultimately about that. You've got these two factions in the church, in the hierarchy. You got two factions in every group. One of them are these traditionalists. And what they're doing now is they're sort of making a power play on Pope Francis. Okay, that's what they're doing. And they're using this McCarrick thing to do it. And what they're embedding their move in is what they really care about, which is about homosexuality. That's what they care about. And they have made the link, and they continue to make the link, which is absolutely unacceptable, which has to be condemned by the Pope, which I don't know where Cardinal Sean O'Malley is, who's ahead of the Papal Commission on addressing this problem. He's the person, he's from Boston, he's the person that the Pope said, you're my number one man on this. This letter, and it's not just his letter, has again openly said and that there's a link between homosexuality and pedophilia. Not only is that factually wrong, it's absolutely false. It is dangerous to say that. And they've got to come out right now, and they better say it. We have a bishop in Madison, Bishop Morlino, who wrote like a four-page letter that he wanted every priest to read on Sunday. And he did the exact same thing in his letter. And he literally says in there that homosexuality, which the church says is a disorder, he said that that disorder calls out for vengeance from the heavens. Listen to what he's saying. That calls out for vengeance. Okay, that's an incitement to harm and violence. That's what that is. And he says in that letter as well, and I am not kidding, you can read this thing, he says what the church needs to do more is hate. It needs to hate more. This is what's coming out of the pastors and shepherds of the Catholic Church in the United States. And that's well beyond some problem in just in their own church. And so that is so dangerous. I can't say this enough. And so they better come out but soon and make this clear. But they haven't. And they're just using this issue of homosexuality in order to make their power play, because they want to run the church, this group.
What can our listeners do if they want to get involved in pushing for reform?
There's two things they can do. The most important thing they can do is to support changes in their state, and in some of these states like Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and elsewhere, it's been underway for some time, to change the civil and criminal statutes on child sex abuse, to eliminate them. And in particular, there is civil legislation and changes called the Child Victims Act. The Child Victims Act. That would allow survivors of sexual violence of any kind from childhood to be able to come forward and file cases in civil court. And that's really important, because that's how you hold offenders accountable, and that's how you hold any institution, not just the Catholic Church, if it's been shown to have covered up for the individual who then assaulted you. So the Child Victims Act, so getting behind those changes in civil and criminal reform in our country, and those statutes. It affects them because they've been so involved in this. But it's one of the things that they can do. They really need to do everything they can to get in contact with their legislators or elected officials and say, we need an investigation by the Justice Department about this. Their senators and their congressmen, because they're the ones that can put the pressure on and make this happen. And then thirdly, they can call their bishop. If they're Catholics, they can call the diocese in where they are, and they can say, you've got to make the three changes that I just talked about. You've got to do this, and you've got to do it now.
Attorney Pam Spees from the Center for Constitutional Rights outlines some critical legal strategies.
In different states, for instance, here in New York, there's been an ongoing battle about these statutes of limitations reform efforts. And we know there was just reporting this week that showed the church had put $2 million into lobbying to block that bill. You know, and that's not uncommon. We see that in different places. So I think, you know, those are important struggles. And it's through the civil cases that have been brought when they could be brought that we get so many of these documents. And we, you know, you have bishops and other church staff put under oath on depositions, and we get important evidence through those cases that have shed a lot of light into how this operates. So I think that's really important. And there are groups who are holding the line and trying to advance on those fronts. I will say that there are calls increasingly in other states to have a state attorneys general, like Josh Shapiro did in Pennsylvania, commence grand jury investigations at the state level of these dioceses, and we're seeing that in Missouri. There are calls in other places for that to happen as well. That's an important component in all of this, and to support those who are also pushing for that, I think. Supporting the organizations that Peter has been involved with. I think it can't be overstated the significance of survivors' voices in all of this, because none of this, literally none of this, not the Pennsylvania report, not the committees in Geneva, the UN committees, not any of these grand juries, not the Boston Globe coverage in 2002, none of that would have happened if survivors had not come forward under the most difficult and complicated of circumstances to speak the word, as Peter said. And I just want to mention a couple of survivors who've been very important, and we've lost them over this past year. And one is Barbara Blaine, who was a founding member, along with Peter and others, of the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. Barbara died suddenly and unexpectedly in late September, and it's a big loss for the movement. But as you can see, the work that she began is continuing on. And then another survivor that we lost, and Peter was very close to, Gary Smith, who was a student at a deaf school in Wisconsin, who, along with many other students, had been sexually assaulted at this deaf school. And those survivors did some of the first street actions, right, in the 70s. They were papering cars, you know, putting flyers out on cars. If you can imagine this community of deaf survivors who also had their disability used and turned against them because that priest could sign, and often their parents couldn't sign. So they were, you know, when you think about the sort of the level and the experiences that people have had to endure, and then what they do with that moving forward, we owe so much to them and what they began doing in the 70s. And there's a really good documentary out that where you can see more about their struggle. And so, and then of course you've heard Peter here today, and the brilliant and fierce battle that he's waging along with so many others, and supporting them and the work that they're doing is key so they can keep going. Because you can imagine, the Pennsylvania grand jury report is getting a lot of attention now, but these folks have been doing this work for decades, and it has not been easy, as you can imagine. There's more, perhaps, interest and some tolerance in the media for these stories, but early on there wasn't, and it was a very isolating battle. So just say that that's one of the most important things that folks can do is find ways of supporting In Clergy Abuse Global and the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests.
Well, Pam mentioned Barbara Blaine, and I remember meeting her so many years ago. And the thing was, is like, you know, many of us around the country had found each other because we had all gone back to the church when we were able to. We were young men and women at the time, most of us in our 20s, and we had gone back and told them what had happened to us, and they made promises to us about how this priest who had assaulted you was never going to get around children, and we really wanted them to do the right thing. We thought they were going to do the right thing. And then when we found out they weren't going to do the right thing, well, what were we going to do? I mean, who was going to stop this? And how were we going to stop it? And we had no idea. we started coming forward. We had to find some way to do this, and we weren't going to get much help. I mean, we understood that. We weren't going to get much help. That moment of coming forward and saying, this has to stop. This happened to me, and this has to stop. And it's very emotional to think about, Barbara. It's very emotional to think about Gary. These group of deaf survivors, it's unbelievable their struggle and what they did. And that case eventually became a global, huge global story in 2010 when we brought these documents to Rome. And that was the first time that this had ever happened in Italy, where they had documents being released. And because that case led to Pope Benedict. He was directly involved in this case before he became Pope. And he left this man in the priesthood. And to think of these deaf survivors and how incredible they are, how awesome they are, and the joy and fun it's been to be with all these survivors. Believe it or not, we're a lot of fun, and to be together with them. And what's important is not so much what happened to us, but what part of us, even as we were being harmed, there was some part of us that resisted. And maybe we couldn't say anything, and maybe we couldn't do anything, and maybe it's taken a long time for us to say and do anything, but that part of us that resisted, that's what it means to be a survivor. And that's about justice, that something came through us that's about justice. And justice is for everyone. Justice is for everyone. It may be our particular issue, but our particular issue, I think, speaks to everyone. Mm-hmm. And that's what we care about. That is justice. And what it means to have the opportunity with Barbara and Gary and so many others to be able to be in that place of trying to speak for justice and to speak for justice and to keep speaking for justice until justice happens.
Peter, this has been a remarkable interview. Thank you for everything that you do and for being so open and sharing with us.
Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.